This episode contains descriptions of violence. Listener discretion is advised. This episode is also the first international interview I've done for this show, which is really cool, but also means I couldn't send a microphone out. So just want to say I did my best with the audio here. Okay, here's the show.
Because he certainly didn't want to be charged with a murder.
In 2008, Peter Brandt was living on Whidbey Island, which is just north of Seattle, Washington.
And the only in and out was by ferry. I was a commercial real estate investor managing apartments and acquiring properties. I had purchased a home that was in need of completing. A Boeing and Microsoft couple had worked over the years on weekends fixing up this house, and it didn't have any interior finishes. It had plumbing, but no electrical. It had a roof, and it had landscaping. And nobody could get financing for it. But with my expertise and my real estate license and so on, the bank agreed that I was capable of managing the project. And they loaned me the money.
With financing secured, Peter needed to find someone to actually do the work.
While I was preparing to find a builder or contractor to assist me on the project, Brent Decker was working with a local friend of mine on replacing a floor in a bedroom. And as I was there and he was doing the work, we kind of hit it off. And at some point, you know, he realized that I had a house that I was going to fix up. And so he wanted to see it. And I took him over there, and he had all kinds of ideas. And he turned out to be quite dynamic. He showed me a portfolio that had custom homes that he had done in California, and they were really tasteful. He put me on the phone one time when he was talking to this guy who, you know, and he was a reference, and he said, you know, this guy is really, really good. He's done a lot of work for me. He's like a master builder. He can design without a plan and build it right then and there. I mean, custom cabinetry and sound systems. He was a Renaissance man.
What did he look like?
You know, he looked a little bit skittish at times, and he was a motor mouth. I mean, he could talk on any subject. I said to myself, this guy's a cross between Michelangelo and Da Vinci.
Once they got electricity working, Peter moved in and lived there full time while work was still being completed on the house.
And not only that, it turned out in conversation with him that he had worked as a chef at one time. So he said, man, I love working for you with you so much. I'm going to bless you with my cooking. And it really was fantastic. You know, it was certainly
wow.
A bonus having him around. You know, it wasn't something that you expect from your contractor.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect to be fed dinner.
But it was taking him some time to, you know, because he was coming from, I'm going to say, you know, maybe 50 miles away, including a ferry trip. And if there was traffic, which, you know, there usually was, then it would really limit the amount of time that he had to work. You know, and so finally, you know, I said, you know, wouldn't it make sense? How about if you stayed here a couple nights a week so we could get more production done? And he said, for some reason, he was going to have to move. But he told me, you know, it'd be better if I just lived here, and you know, there'd be no commute at any time. We just get her done. And I said, okay, that works for me.
So Brent moved in to finish the job. But letting Brent this far into Peter's life would change everything. This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. I just want to ask about what your relationship with him is. Are you friends? Do you guys hang outside of the house?
Well, we would mainly just to get supplies and everything. I generally wouldn't socialize with them, you know, because I had to keep a, as best I could, a business relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't hang out all the time together, but we might take a trip, you know, about 45 minute trip to a Home Depot, get supplies, you know, run some errands and then drive so back to the property.
Friendly, but not friends.
Yeah, that would be a good description. And then in the evenings, he would do art and play his artwork. And it seemed like he'd stay up a good part of the night. And, you know, I thought, God, that's kind of weird. I hear movement around at night. Well, I can't really sleep that well. And, you know, I hope I'm not disturbing you. And then another thing was when the Mormons would proselytize in the area, and when they would come to the door, he would engage them with questions that they would have to go to Salt Lake City administrators to answer. And
like what?
Like, you know, what is the Mormon Church's perspective on anything, you know, abortion, yeah, this and that. And then he was a good debater. So eventually like three or four of them were coming at a time, you know, because they were really serious about answering every question he had, and he loved it. And by the end, you know, there, I think there, the one day there was five people, and he said, he told them before they came, he said, look, I've been listening to you now for several months. And he'd gone to a potluck dinner at the Mormon church with them. And, you know, they were friendly towards each other, but they came, and, you know, for the final time. And he said, I'm going to perform a concert for you because, you know, you're always, you know, telling me your philosophies and, you know, the religious parts of it. And so he got on his guitar. He had an amp set up in the living room, and he actually played a concert for him. And it was just surreal. I'm going, this is just weird.
What kind of music did he play?
It was some kind of rock and roll. You know, I mean, it was really heavy, you know, probably nearing on heavy metal electric guitar.
Yes, famously the Mormons' favorite heavy metal.
Yeah. Can you imagine the picture? I mean, I actually went outside at some point because it was just like, this is over the top for me.
But once the work was complete, Brent didn't seem to be in a hurry to move on.
The project was already complete.
Mm.
And I was trying to point him towards, okay, now, you know, it's time for you to move on. The project's done. He had fallen in love with I had an HD video camera that he really liked, and he liked working with me, and he wanted to shoot vignettes of Whidbey Island to sell to people that wanted to retire there so they could actually feel what the island was like and the beauty and so on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really good at it, but I didn't want him living there anymore. So I had told him, you know, okay, you need to start. Look, I didn't want to push it too hard, but, you know, I was in the process of saying, okay, it's time to move along.
Was he paying rent at all?
He didn't pay rent.
Hmm. Was that ever discussed?
No. I didn't. I don't know whether he would have agreed to that, but my, you know, when you're working with a bank, you don't want to be slow on the project. So I wanted to be able to show progress and not have them question, you know, the viability of the project.
By June 11th, 2008, Brent had really worn out his welcome.
He had met a woman on the bus on the island. And he told me that day, man, I met this gal and I think she's pretty cool. She's quite special. And then I think a day or so later, he said, hey, would you mind if my gal came over and, you know, so she could see the project? I said, no, that'd be fine. So she lived in Seattle, which was about an hour away. And you know, I said, well, would it be okay if she spent the night? Okay. You know, I met her and she was very nice. Mm-hmm. And everything was cool. She stayed the night. And in the morning, I'm hearing stern, almost arguing, I guess what you would call it, and to the point where I said, excuse me, but you can't raise your voice here in my house, so one of you is going to have to step out. Well, she agreed to step out. And while she was outside, I told her, I said, I think that you better go, and I would suggest that you don't come back here. This guy's being a little over aggressive with you, and I don't want that to happen in my house. And I said, I'm going to be on my way soon here to go to my real estate office, which is right near the ferry dock. So I'll be glad to drop you off there. She said, okay. And then I went back in the house, and there he was. And he said, she's probably going to ask you for a ride to the ferry dock. And, you know, I didn't acknowledge that she had done that.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, she got her things and got in my car, and we went on the way to the ferry. And along the way, I got a phone call from him on my cell phone. And he said, Peter, your HD video camera is missing. And we both were using it. And so, you know, essentially, you know, I'm acknowledging that, you know, both of us know that it was there this morning. And so you need to check her belongings. I first explained to her, you know, what was going on, and she agreed to be checked. And I didn't come up with anything. So I said, took her to the ferry and dropped her off. And she got on the ferry and off she went. The next thing was that I, instead of going to my real estate office as I had intended, I felt as if I needed to settle the camera situation with Brent back at the house. So I drive back, I go walk in the door, and he goes, did you find anything? I said, no. I said, she said she didn't have it. You say you don't know where it is. And I said, I'm going to do what people do when they're in a situation like that, is I'm just going to have the police investigate it.
Bringing up going to the police snapped something in Brent.
And when I said that, all of a sudden, I was hit multiple times with about a 3-foot piece of hardwood. In fact, it was coming at me so fast over my head and my shoulders and my body that I couldn't even put together what was happening. It just was a moment that, you know, what is this? Why? And I passed out. And I don't know how long I was out, but when I came to, I thought, this is a very dangerous moment. What am I going to do? I have got to be as creative as I've ever been in my life. And I'm going to have to extricate myself from this. So I thought, well, I'll just run next door to a neighbor.
Where are you in the house at this point?
We're on an upper floor, and there's a stairway nearby. And we tussle going down a staircase to the kitchen. And I can't seem to get out of his grip. And when he gets me to the kitchen, he puts me in a position on my back where I'm next to the set of drawers that had a cutlery drawer. And he pulls out a 2-pronged turkey fork. And he's just about ready to drive it through my heart. He's got it over his head. And I said, is there any reason why somebody needs to die here? I said, we both have sons. I'd certainly want to see my son. I'm sure you'd want to see yours too. Mm-hmm. I said, I forgive you, and I will help you in any way I can. That was my light bulb moment. I thought, you know, when I was thinking about how to handle this, I thought, I'll forgive him.
What made you say that?
I knew that there was a good possibility that I was going to be killed, because there's no way that he could have predicted that I would live with how hard he was hitting me. I mean, I had head injuries. I could feel where I'd been hit on the shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do something unusual, and I was afraid to be physically violent, because even if I could have, because in my mind, I pictured being in a courtroom, and it's my word against his, and he's dead, and how do I explain that to somebody?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to resolve this without any more physical conflict. And so when I told him I forgave him, his eyes went from the look of the devil. Have you ever seen that in someone where they just look like the devil has temporarily got a hold of them? That's what he looked like. And when I said, I forgive you, he melted. And later he told me, he said, if you hadn't forgiven me, I would have killed you, because no one in my life has ever forgiven me. Turned out, I found out later that I think by about age 12, he was living on the street as he felt the need to, to go on his own at that age. So he was apparently streetwise and could certainly take care of himself.
But street smarts can only take you so far after you've attacked your employer and now have to deal with a mess of blood all over the house.
He stood back and he goes, this is a heinous crime. He looked around and said, we've got to get out of here. And I said, well, I've got somebody that's coming over and I'm not sure exactly when. And he said, hey, if anybody walks in this house or knocks at the door, they will be killed and I'm going to bury them under the patio deck. I'm like, well, let's get out of here then, because I really don't want anybody else to have to go through this.
Yeah.
He took me up to the upstairs bathroom and he nursed my wounds. He had a first aid kit. He cleaned, head injuries with alcohol and wrapped my head. It's like, God, one minute you're this evil person, and the next minute you're nursing my wound. It was kind of hard to wrap my head around that.
Peter was doing his best to be cooperative. Brent was being nice now, but obviously could become violent any second. While in the bathroom, Brent put zip ties around Peter's ankles and wrists.
And he said, I'm going to take all my tools and all my belongings, and I'm going to put them in your van. And then he said, we're going to go on the run. I'm going to hand you off to somebody in California. It's like some bikers or something. And then I'll go into Mexico, and then I'll have them hand me off to him. And then we'll be on the run in Mexico together. And I'm like, holy shit, how's this going to work?
Yeah.
I don't know what to expect.
It took Brent about an hour to pack everything and load it into the van.
Eventually, he takes me out to the van, and there's the van is full of tools and his belongings, but there's a shape in the middle of the cargo area that is about the size of my body. And I thought, oh no. So I lay on my back and he's going to drive the highway access to avoid the ferry because he's afraid I might scream or yell when we're on the ferry. So our first stop is at a bank where he demands my debit card and my PIN, and he takes $500 from my account.
Then Brent started driving south, out of Washington and into California.
We drove all night, and I was familiar with Highway 101, which is fairly desolate. And I contemplated, I knew personally that I could open the van even if it was locked from the inside. Then I thought, middle of the night, and I'm going to jump out of the van. And then, what if he catches up with me? And then certainly I'll be finished if he catches me. So I thought, okay, I'll just go with the flow here. And I'm hoping that he's speeding, so that maybe we could be stopped by a police.
What's going through your mind? Because this is hours and hours.
I am incredibly relaxed. I'm almost in a state of, I would call it nirvana. I just was relaxed. I wasn't going to worry. It's going to, there will be a positive outcome. And I realized that anybody else that might be in this position might be screaming, crying, yelling, and probably end up doing something stupid that will end up having you ended.
Yeah.
So I don't know where that came from, but people have told me in the past that, you know, there could be a fire, they say, and you would be the calmest person in the room.
Peter started formulating a plan to get himself out of this situation.
My next strategy was to feign near death. I was moaning and groaning. And it turned out to be quite effective. He stopped at a gas station and he bought vitamins and he brought me water. And again, that was that catch-22 thing where here's this guy that's been your perpetrator is now aiding you in some way. Very confusing. But he says, I know a nurse along this highway, and he said, I want to have her check your condition, because he was afraid, you know, I was going to die based on my behavior.
Right.
And so he says, okay, we're here. I'm going to run in there, and I'll be right back out. And when he came out, he said, she won't see you for ethical reasons. So she says, just get him to a hospital. So he said, we're going to go to Sacramento, and I'm going to drop off all my gear. I'm going to leave it with a mini storage, and then we'll go straight to the hospital after that.
And shockingly, that's exactly what they did.
And I think within 15 or 20 minutes, we were at UC Davis, California. He stops next to the hospital parking lot. He's driving, you know, my van. He's got my cell phone. He's got my wallet. He says, I'm going to be monitoring my warrants, so you don't turn me in, but I'm going to let you go. You give me a 15-minute head start, and after 15 minutes, you can go into the hospital. And then he hands me all my belongings. And he disappears.
Peter didn't know anything about a warrant out for Brent, and that was really the least of his worries at the moment.
So after 15 minutes, I thought I better last the full 15 minutes here. And after 15 minutes, I got up, locked the van up, and I stood outside the hospital and I called my son. I said, Michael, this is your dad. I'm here in California. I've been kidnapped on the overnight, and I've just been released at a hospital. He's like, what? So I said, but I need to, you know, go get medical care. I just want to let you know, and I'll be in bone touch with you. So I go into the hospital, and it's so busy that there are patients stacked up in the hallways. It's crawling with police.
When Peter told police the story, they told him he needed to report the crime in Washington.
And they extend a hospital spokesperson, and they come up to me and they say, hey, they said, can we get you book a hotel room for you? And I said, no, I don't want to be here any longer than I need to. You know, I want to have my medical assistance, and then I want to go home, drive home. I said, okay. So I was in there probably at 1 p.m. and at 10, just after around 10 p.m., I was released. I had staples put in my head, and, you know, they took some x-rays and did a bunch of things.
Peter didn't want to stay in the hospital a single second longer than was necessary, so he left and tried to find something to eat.
And I found an Italian restaurant. Man, that sounds really great. So I park there and saunter into the restaurant. But I was still in my victim clothes. You know, I had blood-spattered clothing.
Yeah.
I now was going on the second day without shaving.
And I'm sure there's blood in your hair. And
yeah. And they're just locking the front door. It's closing time. And the guy looks up at me and he goes, my God, what in the world happened to you? And I said, well, I'm the victim of a kidnapping. And I shared the story with him. And he said, well, it's your lucky day. The dinner's on us, and we're going to stay open for you.
Oh.
I said, thank you very much.
After dinner, Peter went to a mall parking lot for the night.
And I locked myself in the cargo compartment of the van under a bright series of street lights. And I set my alarm for 5 a.m.
Well, why didn't you stay at a hotel?
Because I wanted to be with my kinfolk.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know, instead of sleeping in your car.
I wasn't really in the mood to be exploring for anything other than an Italian restaurant.
The next morning, Peter woke up and started driving home.
I call my former wife, and she's a great communicator and really very responsive in emergent situations. And, you know, she says, look, you need to find a place where you can buy some clothes. And then before you get to Seattle, you need to stop at a truck stop, take a shower, you know, change into new clothes so you don't frighten your son. And I'm so excited to be, headed towards home.
But before he could get to a truck stop and get himself cleaned up, he got pulled over by a police officer.
He says, sir, do you know how fast you were driving? I said, no, sir. I'm sorry. I'm just, recovering from a kidnapping, and I wasn't really paying attention to my speed. Well, you were 30 miles an hour over the speed limit. And he said, but hold on a second. And he ran back to his squad car, he ran my ID, and he came back to the car, and he goes, get out of here. Go report this, go to your home area and, report this. And that was the end of that. So it's just like, get out of here, kid.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure he saw the state of you and was like, I don't want to be.
Because I was afraid. I was afraid they were, they wouldn't believe the story, but they did. He did.
So Peter kept driving and stopped at a truck stop to take a quick shower, then drove the rest of the way to his ex-wife's house. How did you feel being back surrounded by people that you knew and trusted?
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's what you need. I mean, you can imagine you sort of lose a little sense of, of the hope for mankind, when something like this happens. I mean, it's the worst, that you can observe.
The next morning, Peter went to the sheriff's office to report the kidnapping again.
It's a Saturday morning, and there's hardly anybody at the counter. And when I finally arouse somebody, the guy says, oh, I'm sorry, we can't take a report. The sheriff is home, and he's asked not to be disturbed, so I can't contact him. So I suggest that there's another precinct where there's one sergeant stationed about 10 miles from here, so I suggest you go there.
What?
I'm like, okay, buddy, now it's been a couple of days, and this is a federal crime, and I can't talk to your sheriff?
So Peter drove to the other station to try again.
So I drive up to this little precinct, which is essentially a hole in the wall. And there's this crusty old sergeant sitting there, after about 10 seconds, he looks up. What can I do to help you? And I'm like, well, I wanted to report a kidnapping. And he said, of who? I said, of me. So he listens to my story, about 3 minutes of a story. And he goes, you know what? I don't believe you.
Oh my gosh.
I said, why don't you jump in your little squad car and follow me out to the house and I'll show you the DNA evidence of the crime. How about that? So he follows me to my house and we get there. He pulls out a little brownie camera, like it looked like it was about 25 years old, no focus or anything, He's taking pictures of the crime scene. He looks at me very apologetically and he says, I believe you now. And I'm very sorry that he said, we got people that report the craziest things. And this had some of the markings. But it was Saturday by that time. He says, I can't get a detective out here until Tuesday. So he says, take this form and fill out a report. And bring that, hand it over to the detective when you meet on Tuesday.
Does crime just not happen there on weekends? Like, why is no one working?
the light isn't on, you know? I mean, in other words, if it had happened in Seattle, you know, I was told that, you know, there would have been all kinds of advocacy. But there, it's like, you know, sorry, we're closed.
So finally, on a weekday, Peter was able to meet with a detective.
On Tuesday, I get a call from the detective, and he goes, you want to meet at your house? Or I said, how about if we meet at a coffee shop? And so, you know, 20 minutes later, we're sitting over a cup of coffee, and I tell him the story, and he goes, I got one answer for this. I said, what's that? FBI. I go, really? They happen to have an office in Everett, Washington, which was just across the Puget Sound. So they were just there.
Oh.
And it was a moment where you were just proud to be an American, because they were collecting DNA. And he said, do you know how lucky you are? Normally, when we investigate a kidnapping, we're sifting through evidence. There's no person to talk to.
Yeah.
That person was dead. And they said, this is a movie. You've got to make sure this makes it to the movie screen.
If this was a movie, the investigation probably would be wrapped up in a neat little bow in a few days. But in reality, it took nearly 2.5 years to catch Brent. Even though the FBI was actively looking for him, Peter didn't feel safe with him still out there.
The last thing he told me is, you know, if you report me, I'll be monitoring my warrants. And if you report me, I'll either kill you or have you killed. You understand that? So during that time, here I am on this island, and anytime somebody would knock on the door or I'd receive a phone call, you know, where there wasn't anybody on the other end of the line, I would just sweat. You know, it just made me very anxious. Later, I realized I was diagnosed as having PTSD from the incident.
When did you first start experiencing symptoms?
Well, right away. I mean, I had been working in a real estate office. On my own account, I was investing in multifamily properties. I was managing my portfolio. And when I would go into that office, you know, I'm sitting there in the office and I'm just thinking, what's it all about, Alfie? You know, it's like, what's important? I mean, the only things that are important are human relationships and doing the right thing and, you know, living your life with honor. And all the rest is just cake decoration.
Right.
I was so anxious. I couldn't sit in that real estate office and pretend like I cared about the work, because it didn't really matter. Coincidentally, the world downturn was happening.
Yeah, this is 2008.
Yeah, at the same time. So fortunately, I'd been able to sell my properties when they were at the peak of the market. So I had funds to live on, and I could live throughout the entire economic downturn. Otherwise, I would have had a double whammy. I would have been dealing with my PTSD and trying to figure out how to work. It took 2.5 years to catch this guy. The FBI finally caught him in the act.
Brent was arrested in California for failing to register as a sex offender. According to court reports, Brent had committed 3 armed robberies and attempted to escape from prison before he entered his 20s. After Brent was released from prison for the robberies, he raped and strangled his wife. His wife survived the ordeal, and Brent returned to prison. Upon his release this time, Brent needed to register as a sex offender, which he did not. When he was arrested after kidnapping Peter, it had been his 3rd time failing to register. Brent pled guilty to the kidnapping.
You know, eventually they say, you know, he's admitted to this thing, and he's willing to cop a plea. And, you know, I asked him, I said, I don't really want to go to a hearing. I don't have anything to do with him. I don't want to see him. They said, well, we've got to deal with him. He'll serve 14.5 years. And I said, okay, let's go ahead and do that. And I don't want to attend the proceeding. And they said, okay, that's fine.
Why didn't you want to go?
I just didn't need, you know, I'd already experienced the crime. There just was no need to be there other than maybe for some kind of ego gratification. But I didn't need that.
Right.
So why go? I think the guy was about maybe 38 years old. And the judge said, you know, by the time he's released from prison, he'll be, you know, an aging man. And all the piss and vinegar will probably be out of him, he said.
Brent Decker is still in federal prison. But Peter still had to live with the consequences of what happened to him, which included the need for a new job.
You know, the state asked me, what can we do for you? Okay, I need to be connected, reconnected with a vocation where I can do something that doesn't make me anxious. And one of the first places they referred me to was Starbucks was offering a position. And I'm going, when I go in a Starbucks and I see people ordering, you know, double latte with cornstarch whip, you know, I'm like, there's no way I can keep up with all those descriptions. I said I'd last there about one day. The good thing about it was there was a counselor there with the state that was really understanding of the situation. What they gave me was understanding and communication with the seriousness of what had happened and how to, you know, build back. And that really helped because, you know, even from people that I knew, you know, some people were like, why can't you just get over this? You know, like somehow you can just, you know, unplug a circuit and then, you know, the whole thing goes away. There has to be some grieving period.
Yeah. You have to kind of come to terms with this whole new life.
Yeah. So one that was really helpful, the state had recommended, you know, that there was a job fair that I should go to. And I meet this lady she said she represented the Mormon church and that they had an employment agency. And she says, you don't need to be religious to be part of our service.
Hmm.
And she says, it's a worldwide network and we have a global curriculum. They had a classroom, computers, and then they would meet every single weekday. And there would be a couple people from the agency there. And so that structure really helped me in a time where, you know, I was struggling to find, you know, how to cope.
What did you do for work?
I had an associate that was also a property owner. And so I was involved in managing some of the properties. And then I also did some work at Home Depot and Macy's as a cashier.
Okay.
You know, it didn't fulfill who I was, but it was, you know, a routine. And, you know, I could go through the motions.
While his routine was really helpful for Peter to manage his PTSD, something would come along that would completely disrupt that. Love.
Ultimately, I met a woman that was Filipino and is very understanding and has a lot of empathy. And we turned out to be a great match. So I ended up retiring at age 63. You know, we had decided to marry. And then I was able to leave the U.S. and put all this behind me.
Today, Peter happily lives in the Philippines with his wife.
And then I got involved with Zumba, of all things.
Oh.
I was told, you know, you'll really enjoy this. If you like music and you want to dance, you're going to love this. Okay, I'll give it a try. The Zumba takes place in the local malls, and it's actually the entertainment at the mall.
Oh.
So I'm dancing like with 100 Filipino women, and then there's me.
This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.